So the first thing that I would like to do is to read some of the highlights from the beginning part of Steps of Transformation. On page 8 in the foreword that was written by Bishop Callistos makes several points that have to do with the agreement between Orthodox Christianity and the STEPS programs of organizations like Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, Father Melitos Weber, who wrote this book, draws attention to various points of contact between AA and the Orthodox tradition. I myself noticed three things in particular that AA shares with a book to which I've devoted many thousands of hours as a translator, the Philokalia. Both are saying to us, each in its own way, number one, live in the present moment. Quote, see, now is the acceptable time. See, now is the day of salvation. 2 Corinthians 6:2, unquote. We can only make decisions in the present moment, Bishop Callistos says, and we can only encounter God in the present moment, as the members of AA insist, one day at a time. So it is the actual reality of what we do, what we choose, and how we actually do experience and encounter God. That is where the center of things are. We can only live in the present moment, and that is constantly the case. We can't live in the past. We can't live in the future. We can only live in the present moment, one day at a time. So there is one point of agreement with the Philokalia. Number two, no one is saved alone. Quote, we are members of one another, unquote. This is from Ephesians 4:25. We are members of one another. Sometimes when Orthodox emphasize this, people who are not Orthodox think, well, they're against individualism, these Orthodox Christians. They are highly emphasizing the collective experience of human beings together as human beings in a way that seems very anti-individualistic to me. My own Christian faith is highly individualistic. Well, it's difficult to argue with St. Paul in Ephesians 4:25 when he says we are members of one another. We are members of one another, and we are members of the body of Christ. So we are united to Christ, not as isolated individuals, but because as human beings we are meant to be one with God, and we are members of one another. When Jesus says, love your brother as you love yourself, according to the ancient tradition that he is quoting from already, the Old Testament tradition, our brother is ourself. We cannot be who we are without others. That's our nature as human beings. St. Paul teaches that. And, interestingly, the STEP programs also emphasize that the only way to get out of an addiction is to be involved with the lives of others who are at the same place that we are, and to deal with our difficulties as members of a group, a support group. Where the Philokalia, Bishop Callistos says, speaks more of spiritual fatherhood and motherhood, the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is based on spiritual brotherhood and sisterhood, but the underlying principle is the same. In the words of Father Melitios, action requires interaction. Action requires interaction. We are healed by sharing our experience with each other, by listening to each other. Okay, Bishop Callistos' third point, we depend upon a power greater than ourselves. A third main point of the STEP programs that where they are in agreement with Orthodox Christianity. John 15:5, without me you can do nothing, Christ says. There are few, if any, of Christ's sayings that the Philokalia, Bishop Callistos says, quotes more often than this. In every human situation, we're going to say to ourselves, in the words of Father Melitios, I cannot, God can, and I am going to let him. That's what we say. I cannot, in isolation, do anything. But God can, and I am going to cooperate with him. I'm going to let him. That cooperation is absolutely essential. That is the nature of Mary's response to Gabriel's announcement. In common with Orthodox theology, AA thinks in terms of synergia, of the creative cooperation between divine grace and human freedom. What God does is immeasurably greater than we can do, but the active involvement of our free will is also essential. For as Father Miletios reminds us, repentance, like forgiveness, is not a feeling, but a decision. Repentance is not a feeling, but a decision. If we wait until we feel like going to confession, we will never go to confession, because nobody ever feels like going to confession. We decide to go to confession. That's our point. That's our part. We decide, we choose, and we go. We turn around, we repent, we orient ourselves toward God, and we start moving. That's our part. We can do that part. If we can't do that part, nothing's going to happen. But we can. Okay, in the introduction to this book, there's some sections that I want to pull out. This book, Father Weber says, has two main purposes. The first is to explore the 12 steps of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, to explain them to those who may be unfamiliar with them. And you might ask, well, why should we do this? Well, I would say there are two reasons. One reason is that as a support group for those members who have addictions, whether they're alcohol, whether they're drugs, or whether there are these many other things that we all as Americans seem to become addicted to, we need to be a support group for one another. We've already emphasized the importance of our being there for one another. So to explore the 12 steps and to show why the steps are important in helping people to recover from addictive behavior. The second purpose of the book is to present the 12 steps in such a way that members of the Orthodox Church might find them a valuable resource for their own personal spiritual development, should they choose to use them. Father Peter Smith, not too long ago, he used to have a column in the Dawn called Afflictions and Addictions, which he published faithfully for, I think, years. Afflictions and Addictions. And the point is that we all have behaviors or particular ways of missing the mark, particular sins that seem to be repetitive for us over and over. At the bottom, there could be some kind of addictive behavior that we need to break out of. And Father Peter focused on that sort of thing in his column. So there is a close relationship here between breaking out of that kind of addictive behavior and the method that works. If there's a method that works to enable us to do that, then it is related to us, regardless of whether we have any difficulties with drug or alcohol or whether we don't. An alcoholic's condition, jumping over to page 12, is generally obvious to those who know them. Others are addicted to other substances, and still others are addicted to dangerous or antisocial behaviors. Although some addictions are very difficult to detect, each is potentially as devastating as alcoholism in its most virulent form, that is to say, in its worst, in its strongest form. Addiction is such a common phenomenon in the modern world that it is often necessary to deal with it before other, more traditional forms of spiritual education can be attempted. Those who are addicted to some behavior or substance need to address their addiction before they can profitably use other traditional means of spiritual growth. In fact, using traditional methods of spiritual encouragement with addicts and alcoholics is usually fruitless and may actually do more harm than good. It is possible that everyone alive, particularly anyone who lives in relative affluence, is affected by addiction in one form or another. It may be very beneficial for as many people as possible to have at least some knowledge of the 12 steps and how they work, because this is the sort of thing that is going to give us insight into that kind of behavior and make it possible for us to not have our spiritual life restricted just to dealing with that sort of thing. Since each of the 12 steps can be shown to share some element in thought and experience, the scripture and prayer life of the Orthodox Church, I hope, Father Weber says, to demonstrate that it is quite possible for Orthodox Christians to incorporate these steps into their own lives in order to deepen their spiritual experience. And he mentions at the end of this introduction If anyone reading this book thinks that he may be an alcoholic or even fears that he might be, his best hope for recovery would be to put down this book and get into contact with a local group of AA as quickly as possible. An alcoholic needs the 12 steps, but he needs them within the context of the fellowship of AA. So in this practical program that is pre-Christian, really pre-Christian, all of these elements that Bishop Callistos pointed out as being there, kind of built into the fact that we are the kind of beings that we are as human beings, that's why they're there in this kind of practical approach to dealing with addictive behavior, which is not even yet Christian on the one hand, and they're also there in Orthodox Christianity, because in both cases, Orthodox Christianity is very practical. It deals with the reality of things. AA got to be what it is by doing exactly the same thing, and that's where the points of agreement come from, because in both cases you're dealing with the actual reality of what it means to be a human being in the kind of world that we live in. I want to jump over to chapter 1, Introduction to the 12 Steps, just mainly to get them out on the table more or less, and then I want to move on. I've already made the point, or already mentioned it at least, that the idea that alcoholism and all addictive behavior is a physical disease was a new idea at one time. Before, the idea was that addictive behavior is simply moral weakness. And the idea was, and there's a stigma on that, of course, because, well, you ought to not be doing that. You ought to have stronger character. But once it sets in, just like any kind of infection sets into the body and takes over, then you can't say, well, you should just not be so morally weak as to have this infection, to have this disease. If you're dealing with something that is a physical disease, then it's a different situation. It's interesting to me, though, in addition to that, that when we begin Great Lent, we talk about the fact, I always try to mention, that in spiritual effort, we take hold of our spiritual lives by the body. The body has a role in spiritual life. We tell the body, fast, you know, fast from meat, fast from dairy, fast from these things. The body's role is to be how we go about doing the spiritual life, because spiritual life is a matter of what we do. And we do the things that we do in this physical world as physical beings by way of our bodies. Our bodies are meant to have participation in our spiritual lives. Spiritual life is not something that is disassociated from the body. It doesn't have anything to do with the body. Body's bad. The idea that the body is bad and we won't have anything to do with the body, it's not going to work, because God created us as physical human beings who are physical and spiritual at the same time. The body is not meant to be addicted. It's not meant to lead. It's meant to follow the spiritual orientation toward God. And it is by way of the body that we move in that direction. In this practical sort of program, it's been discovered that that is the case. That the only way you are going to be able to deal with any kind of an addictive problem is to start with the fact that you've got a physical illness. There is something wrong with you at a physical level, and you have to start at that level. It's the same sort of thing that we do at the beginning of Great Lent when we say we are going to fast. Tell the body to do this, and the body will enable you to move in this direction. Same sort of thing, same sort of realism. So, you're dealing here with a physical disease. It has characteristics that you can define. It has causes. It has a series of progression and development that inevitably leads, left untreated, to death. And there is a treatment. Father Weber then makes a major point. He says that there is a great surprise when it comes to the treatment for this medical condition, because the treatment turns out to be something quite different from what we would expect from our ordinary medical model, where we treat physical conditions by using doctor writes a prescription, here, take this, this will cure you. That won't work. Won't work in this case. Even traditional mental health programs don't address the problem, according to the STEP programs and Father Weber as an Orthodox priest. is impressed with the fact that they have discovered this, the STEP people, and agrees. The most successful treatment for this physical and mental disease turns out to be spiritual in nature. Well, this word spiritual can mean a lot of different things, so he gives us a quick definition. Spiritual generally means something to do with one's connectedness with God and with the rest of the universe, with a higher power, as AA would put it. It seems fairly clear, Father Weber says, that if this spiritual treatment becomes too religious, the healing stops. Now, he's describing what has been discovered to be the case within AA since the 1930s when it began. If the spiritual treatment becomes too religious, the healing stops. Now, we're not going to examine right now why that's the case. Father Weber does talk about that later. Put more clearly, if this spiritual treatment becomes too religious, it hardly gets a chance to start. Religion becomes a place to hide from dealing with the realities. To be successful, the treatment has to be based on a spirituality that stops short of blossoming into a religious faith. It has to be a spirituality in which God himself remains anonymous. Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous. The alcoholic is anonymous individually as members of a group. You know, it's traditional, give your first name. And God himself is anonymous. Why is that? Father Weber says there are very important reasons why this strange phenomenon should be as it is. And it is the underlying intention of this book to describe not only why it has to be like that, but also how this phenomenon can be used to strengthen and develop a person's spirituality within his or her own religious tradition. So we'll come back to that at some future point, but it's good to have that out here at the beginning. And here a list of the 12 steps. First, we admitted we were powerless over whatever it is, that our lives had become unmanageable. Number two, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. It's a function of orientation. In other words, it actually has to be something that happens. There actually has to be a turning toward something higher. And at this point, doctrine, theology is not critical. What is critical is that this is done, that this happens. Number three, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Because it's starting with us wherever we happen to be. It's not starting with a high theology, and I've heard alcoholics say, as an excuse not to become involved with a group, an excuse for ignoring the 12 steps and just kind of generally dumping on the step program altogether. Well, they say, God could be anything. I'm good Orthodox. We have this theology. God is this, God is that. I'm not going to become involved with that. In other words, what? What does that mean? I am not going to do it. Where the reality is, that's the most critical thing. You must do this. You must acknowledge the higher power. Not debate theology, but actually do it. That's the critical point. And then numbers 4 and 5, probably the most difficult steps in a way that people come back to over and over again. Number 4, we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Okay, if you're going to make a serious moral inventory and you have grown up within the kind of society that we live in, where the idea of moral values has come to be understood as relative to our own individual ideas about morality, what you choose as your own values, this is going to be a very difficult inventory to make. A clear and traditional universal understanding of moral values can be very helpful. In the first century, St. Paul and the other apostles had the advantage of living in a society where there was such an understanding. Of course, that doesn't mean that just because there was such an understanding, people lived according to those moral values. For the most part, just like today, they did not. On the part of those who were not yet Christians, there was a consensus as to what those universal, traditional moral values were. St. Paul, in his letters, speaks to that. He recognizes the already existing understanding on the part of pagan Greeks and Romans as to what moral life is actually like. He has praise for
those traditional moral values. Sometimes he calls them the household virtues, the virtues that you can't run a household without. Today we might call them family values. He knows that he can start with an existing understanding of those things. Today we've become very confused as to whether or not there really are traditional moral values. Some people even try to reduce Christianity to some kind of religious substitute for not having a good grip on what moral values are actually like. But Christianity really can't begin without that. Moral values are not a great mystery. The ancient Chinese understood them. The ancient Greeks and Romans before Judaism and Christianity, you find that understanding there. But we today are very confused, and we need to have these things clarified, because our confusion is screwing up our effort to ascend to the heights of Christian life. I would argue that a presentation like Russell Goh's Character is Destiny can be very helpful at just that point. We need to banish the idea that we're dealing with things that are very vague, things that are a matter of personal opinions. That's not the case. What's actually happening to us is the same thing that happens to any addicted person. We become very clever at making things seem fuzzy. We become very clever at deceiving ourselves and one another about things that any traditional society is crystal clear on. No traditional society understands moral values as being kind of shifty and vague and relative.
Number 5, we admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Now, this is unusual in the Western tradition. Why can't I just confess to God? Why do I have to confess to a priest? There are fundamental, practical level reasons for why that is the case. So fundamental, so practical, that a program like this, in which there is no theology, but simply what works, and what works they do. And it does not work unless we admit to a higher power, however we conceive of that higher power, to ourselves and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. Specifically and particularly, oftentimes a priest will say, don't just give me a kind of general survey of your character defects. What in particular, in what particular way have you missed the mark?
What did you do?
Same thing here. Interesting when these things overlap, when they agree. Number 6, we were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Now, there's a lot more in that than what we might think when we first read it over. We were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. You're talking about putting yourself out for a lot of suffering, really, to ask God and sincerely be handing yourself over to have these things removed, because you're addicted to these things. Number 7, we humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Number 8, we made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Oftentimes, priests will say in confession, is there any way that you can repay if you've taken some money? Or have you made things right between yourself and this person that you've had this flaring up of anger with, that sort of thing? Anything else does not deal with reality. Number 9, we made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Funny how people will sometimes be so self-righteous as to say, well, I had to make this right, and they actually end up doing something that is hurtful to someone else. That additional provision is in there, except when to make direct amends would injure them or others, where we're not making amends if we're doing that. Number 10, we continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. You never get to a situation where it's just said and done and passed, taken care of. No, you have to continue to live in this kind of way. You break the hold of addiction. Of course, alcoholics always say, you always remain addicted to whatever it is that you are addicted to. It never becomes entirely something that is past. You have to continue to work on it. This is another similarity with the nature of Christian spiritual life. This is the life. To live this life of spiritual movement toward God. It doesn't end. There's not a point where you never have to deal with it. It's by means of dealing with whatever it is you're dealing with that you have motion, that you have movement, that you have change. Number 11, we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him. Anything else would not be starting where the person is. Praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Number 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to other people who are addicted to behaviors or substances and to practice these principles in all our affairs. What the steps do, Father Weber points out, is simply to list a number of actions that are entirely spiritual in nature. There's no step that says, don't drink, don't use drugs, don't indulge in pornography or on the internet, don't, or whatever it is, whatever the addiction is. There's no step that says, don't do that anymore. The steps don't even say, go join a group. What they say is, do these 12 spiritual actions, because those are the things that need to be done. Father Weber points out that even though these steps began with the experience of those who were dying from alcohol addiction, almost at once they were adapted for use by the families, most often the wives, and friends, this was the history, and friends of those alcoholics. The purpose of this adaptation was to encourage the families and friends of alcoholics to work on their own spiritual development and not, as most would expect, to get the alcoholic to stop drinking. Al-Anon and Alateen are fellowships for the relatives and friends and the children of alcoholics, respectively. Later, the 12 steps were adapted for use by large numbers of others who discovered that the pattern of action that they describe provide an opportunity for recovery from a wide variety of addictions and compulsions, each of which was capable of making life difficult, if not impossible. And that was the background that I wanted to get from that book. What I really want to do is move on to some brief sections from Character's Destiny. Our last book, Ascending the Heights, has to do with the Ladder of Divine Ascent of John Climacus, John of the Ladder, the Orthodox Christian spiritual tradition. We could, of course, just focus on that. But the thing is that we would not be realizing that there are other things that we can get out of the way in order to be able to focus on the spiritual life that is unique to us as Christians, as Orthodox Christians, really. True Christians is all I really mean by that. But there is a practical foundation, a foundation of character and the things that we are addicted to. And as Americans, we have lots of addictions. And it's good for us to be aware of the fact that there is such a thing as character that we can work on, and there is something that keeps us from working on character, that dissolves character, erodes character.
And I have to add here that this point about the existence of a method that works to break out of addictive behavior is one of the reasons that I think it's important to add things like the STEP program and GOES, Character is Destiny, a classic summary of traditional pre-Christian and universal understanding of how to build character. Why is that important? Why is it important that we should have things like a method to break out of addictive behavior on one hand, and on the other hand, a method of building character if we are Orthodox Christians? Priests and Orthodox writers are constantly pointing out to us there is no method, no series of steps by which we can achieve salvation, by which we can achieve fulfillment of the stature of Christ, by which we can achieve perfection in the sense that God demands it of us, that Jesus demands it of us. But here we have some methods for building character, some methods for dealing with the dissolution and breakdown of character as a result of addiction to certain behaviors. So there are two different sorts of things going on here. On the one hand, there are methods that are helpful and universal, even though they start before the point at which
the uniqueness of Christianity and God's call to us to be perfect as He is perfect, where that call begins. So we're dealing with two different things here. On the one hand, we want to not misunderstand about Christianity and not think of our spiritual life as Christians as a method for self-improvement. But that doesn't mean that self-improvement and moral character development and breaking out of dissolutions of our character is not important. In the early centuries, catechumens had a long period before they entered into the Christian faith. 3 years was normal. But that period of 3 years was devoted not to instruction and doctrine and teaching. It was devoted to a period of time during which the prospective Christian separated himself or herself from the kind of addictions and dissolution of character that had plagued them in the outside world. It was a period that was devoted to a kind of character building and preparation to be baptized. So there are two different things here. When it comes to moral life, there are things that can be done even before we are Christians. And those things are universal when it comes to morality and character. If we never make any effort to do those things, and we simply assume, as Western Christians often do, that God is going to do all of it for us, and it's going to come about as a result of the fact that we have united ourselves to Christ, then we're going to be morally and spiritually confused throughout our lives. That's why 3 years were devoted before a prospective escapee from the pagan world of Greece and Rome into the Christian community. That's why 3 years were devoted to breaking out of addictions. That's how we would say it today. So that's why these methods are important. No, there is not a method of salvation. When we get to St. John of the Ladder and ascending the heights, we'll find that there is no method, because now we are going beyond the pre-Christian development of character and breaking out of addiction. And somebody might say, well, do you mean to tell me that up until that point, God is not involved? Well, of course God is involved. God created the universe. God is involved even before He reveals Himself to the Jews. God is involved certainly long before God becomes incarnate and takes a hand to make something possible that has been lost to us. But as Orthodox Christians, we know that the Old Testament path of righteousness was not impossible until Jesus Christ came. Now, we live in a secular society, and we need to extract ourselves out of that society and do that 3-year pre-Christian effort of breaking afflictions and addictions so that we can begin to ascend to the perfection of Christ, which is an entirely different sort of deal that we cannot do without the incarnate Son of God, Jesus, the Christ Himself. You could say, well, we're already baptized Christians. It's too late for us. No. We still have those afflictions and addictions. We still have weaknesses of character that prevent us from beginning the ascent into the perfection of Christ.
So, character. Oftentimes I've recommended this book to those who misunderstand the Christian life as character development. Character development is possible. There are whole moral traditions in ancient Greece and ancient Rome that focus on character development. The Brits used to do it back in the old empire days. You know, it was basically they were doing the same sort of thing in their tradition that the Romans had done. They took over the Roman tradition of character development. Stiff upper lip, how do you get one? Character development. That's where it comes from. So the foreword is only a couple pages long, and there are some sections that I want to read from it just to get you into this idea. And the author is Russell Goh, The book is Character is Destiny, The Value of Personal Ethics in Everyday Life. It's a good book. T.S. Eliot, the American poet who lived in England so much that he more or less started talking and sounding and looking like an Englishman, but he was an American poet, T.S. Eliot, once observed that some of his contemporaries were in the habit of, quote, dreaming of systems so perfect that no one will need to be good, unquote. Set up a situation where the government or the church or some organization controls things and gives us absolute freedom to do whatever we want. Dreaming of systems so perfect that no one will need to be good. The dream of finding a substitute for character. The dream of finding a substitute for character. Relieve the individual of the responsibility for acting for themselves. After all, being good is hard work. How much better if, by some happy arrangement, society could discover the right technical or governmental solution to problems, such as incivility, living in such a way, acting in such a way that makes civilization impossible, or makes, strictly speaking, city life, life of human beings together, impossible, incivility. Technical or governmental solution to problems such as incivility, crime, drug abuse, and irresponsible sex. Let's make some laws to control this sort of behavior. A number of these technical solutions have already been tried, but they never seem to improve our situation, and they never manage to relieve us of our responsibilities. The dream of a society so perfect that no one will need to be good is really a child's dream. It betrays a hope that the grown-ups, in quotes, grown-ups, society, the government, will take care of everything so the rest of us can just play. This is exactly the kind of attitude we might expect to arise in a culture where so many people are in search of their own inner child, and it helps to explain why, when hurt in the pursuit of play and pleasure, so many look for someone else, a corporation, a product manufacturer, to blame. We need to stop dreaming. The truth is, there is no substitute for personal character, and there never will be. By the same token, there is no way to educate young people for character in the absence of adults with character. You have to have examples. Character development is not something the schools can do through the introduction of some new, technically perfect curriculum. Rather, the best way for a young person to learn good habits of behavior is by identifying with and imitating adults who already practice those habits. By making adult character education its primary focus, Character is Destiny, this book, reminds us that the process of cultivating virtue and overcoming vice in one's personal character does not, should not, end simply because one has entered adulthood. The idea that once you get to be an adult, you can do whatever you want because your parents aren't telling you what to do anymore. Indeed, it reminds us that being of adult age is one thing, but actually being adult, in the sense of exemplifying moral maturity as a matter of regular practice, is quite another. And perhaps more tellingly, it reminds us that no matter who we are, and no matter how ethically comfortable or self-satisfied we have become, all of us fall short of perfection and thus should steadfastly keep striving to become fully grown moral beings. What does it mean, from a moral point of view, to be an adult? Character, the word Aristotle uses to describe moral maturity, means enduring marks. Characters are letters, numbers. Those are characters. And the marks that Aristotle is talking about is the mark that has been made on us. Kind of in the Bible, it talks about a seal that is made, some impression that's made that is enduring. It doesn't go away. And as young people, our parents hoped to make an impression and succeeded to varying results. If they were good parents, they tried to make the right impressions, impress things on us, and on again succeeded to one degree or another. Enduring marks. The Greeks believed that human children needed to be trained into human behavior. Now, kids are not naturally fully human. They need to be trained into human behavior. Father Michael Alexa would agree with that from a Tlingit point of view, incidentally. The Tlingits look at it the same way. It's interesting. There is something lasting about a person of character. A person of character does not change with the seasons, is not, in Shakespeare's words, quote, a pipe for fortune's finger to sound what stop she please. In other words, whatever, wherever the wind blows through the pipe, and the natural response to the wind of our emotions, that's what we do. Another wind, you know, we do that. No choice, no direction, no character, just whatever. This is a book about being a person of good character, a person of virtue. We all know people who, though we may agree with them on issues of the day, are people we can never really trust. And so we have agreement on those issues, but there's a problem as far as character. Conversely, the other way around, we all know others who we trust implicitly, even though we don't see eye to eye on politics, for example. This book's sole allegiance is to the ethical character that allows all people, regardless of political persuasion, to live lives of integrity. It is a book for everybody because it speaks to us on the most fundamental level as free moral agents. The last ball that I want to get into the air will come from some notes from the introduction. I'm not going to try to get any further than that. You've been very patient so far. I may maybe hate my guts by this point. I'm not sure. No, hope not. Here Go is going to talk about what character has to do with friendship, which is a central idea that Aristotle has in his writings about ethics. And when it comes to ethics, nobody's better than Aristotle. I mean, his writings on ethics are still cutting edge in the 21st century, which is pretty amazing. A personal conversation between friends about personal character. That, in a nutshell, describes the spirit in which I've written this book. By using the expression between friends, I'm not trying to be either cute or quaint. Quite the contrary. My intent is both sincere and high-minded. And it is not unlike the spirit in which the ancient Greek philosopher Aristotle wrote about friendship over 2,300 years ago. In his Nicomachean Ethics, and it's called such a long name just because there was a guy by the name of Nicomachus, you know, so it could be, Fred's Ethics, you know, that's all it amounts to. In his Nick's Ethics. In Nick's Ethics, still widely regarded as the most complete book ever written on the subject of ethics and character, Aristotle devoted the single greatest portion of the work, nearly one-fourth, to a discussion of friendship. Aristotle's idea was that if you don't have friends, forget it. You know, you're not going to have ethics. It has to be based on a relationship between human beings. We've heard that twice already. Once within the context of AA. Once within the context of Orthodox Christianity, the group is essential. Friendship. But why, you might be wondering, would he spend so much time talking about friendship in a book about ethics and character? For Aristotle, the truest friendship is far more than mere companionship, mutual hobbies, and a common network of acquaintances. Friends, in the highest sense of the term, are those who make a conscientious effort to take ethics and personal character seriously and inspire each other to be better in thought, in action, and in life.
Jesus said to his apostles, I call you friends.
Indeed, for Aristotle, as for all the great moral thinkers throughout human history, nothing could be more important in the quest to improve our individual lives or our society than giving serious attention to personal character. I'm going to make the point even more boldly, Go says. It is impossible to improve our individual lives or our society without genuinely caring about and striving to improve personal character. You must genuinely care about your personal character. I must genuinely care about mine, and we must genuinely care about each other's as friends. I often tell a story of a 20-something baseball player who sincerely tried to convince me that he had no control over his explosive temper, specifically when an umpire had made a bad or merely questionable call. The player wasn't trying to argue that he shouldn't be punished for bumping or screaming demeaning expletives at umpires. He was simply arguing that he was short-tempered by nature, and that his bad temper was thus uncontrollable. So I bluntly asked him, in these situations, why don't you just take your bat and beat the umpire over the head to a bloody pulp so that he won't ever be able to make another bad or questionable call? The baseball player, of course, was quite shocked by my question and replied, how can you even suggest such a thing? I couldn't possibly do that. To which I then responded, well, how is it then that you can control your temper at one point, but not at another. Doesn't this show that you are squarely in the position of choosing at which point you will or will not control your temper? So let's be honest from the onset. Despite the fatalistic, I can't help it, attitudes so prevalent in our day, the truth is that we do have control over and can overcome our weaknesses of character. The responsibility ultimately lies with each adult individual. And the chapters in Go's book are designed to encourage practical self-reflection. Each chapter will begin with a thought-provoking quotation about character, and the titles try to capture the force and point of each chapter. And he leaves us with some questions. What about my character and the attitudes that flow from it? Second, could it be that my character is partly, if not greatly, responsible for my personal struggles and even for my society's problems? I remember clearly the first time I recognized as a young person that the things that I hated most about the way society is screwed up are functional in me. And I think well into my 20s, I was able to conceal that fact from myself and to maintain an accusative attitude towards society in general. I was virtuous. It was not. It was a great shock to realize that I was implicated in the things that I most disliked about society outside of myself. The beginnings of adulthood, I think, come late to us as Americans. Number three, could it be that my character is necessarily an important part of the solution to these problems? That's just a major bummer. Major bummer. I'll mention this and I'll be quiet. The title, Character is Destiny, is a quotation from an ancient Greek writer by the name of Heraclitus, and Aristotle, a good Greek that he is, agrees with Heraclitus on at least this point. We haven't gotten to ascending the heights, but if we tried to do that, I would go over our ordinary time.